seated. Good morning. The next case before the court this morning is Gustav Johnson versus Kenneth Markvey. For the appellant, we have George Nelson, who's present arguing, and for the appellee, we have Heather Lammers-Bogard, who is present and will be arguing. Each side will have 15 minutes initially to present your arguments, and then Mr. Nelson, you'll have a five-minute rebuttal. With that, Mr. Nelson, you may proceed with your first 15-minute argument.
Chief Justice Jensen, justices, opposing counsel, may it please the court. I'm here before the court seeking the reversal of the trial court's opinion or ruling granting summary judgment to the appellee. The basis for this seeking is that my client contends that there were three errors committed by the trial court. First, the trial court improperly weighed the evidence. Second, the trial court failed to make a determination as to the validity of the appointment of the power attorney. And lastly, the trial court abused its discretion when it made its ruling for summary judgment prior to the completion of discovery. Addressing the first argument, my client contends that the facts were not put into the light most favorable to the non-moving party, which was my client. The facts were put into the light, most favorable light, for the moving party. Trial court, instead of giving the preference or the inference in favor of the non-moving party, my client, decided to weigh the evidence and weighed the evidence against my client. Reasonable doubts should have been resolved against the moving party, but they were not. Facts and evidence that were presented by the non-moving party, my client, were of substance and of a degree that shift the burden of proof to the moving party. My client had presented evidence that centered around the cognitive functioning of the decedent or the lack thereof. We ask that this court take in perspective the fact that the decedent, Susan Markvey, on the 15th of January 2013, entered into a prenuptial agreement with the defendant here, or the appellee, and that prenuptial agreement made a determination as to whose property was whose. In August of 2013, my client, consistent with that prenuptial agreement, purchased a house in Hot Springs for $250,000 and purchased it with her own money. Now, circumstances changed for her. In the fall of 2013, she started to exhibit unusual behaviors that were so noticeable that, for instance, one incident, she drove from Hot Springs to Rapid City for the purpose of attending a Sons of Norway event. After the event, instead of returning to Hot Springs, she ended up in Wall. It's about a 100-mile difference, and if anybody has traveled out of Rapid City to either of those towns, there's a distinct difference between Highway 79 and I-90. It's an example of how her mental capacity was being affected by brain cancer. The other behavior was exhibited during the Thanksgiving dinner, in which Gus Johnson, her brother, noticed such behavior that he tried to get her to see a doctor. That, in fact, even that evening, to go to the emergency room. It didn't happen until a day or so later, I guess probably the Monday after Thanksgiving, when she did go to for an examination, and a CAT scan was done, and a walnut-sized tumor was detected in her frontal lobe.
Mr. Nelson, can I interrupt you for just a moment, please, and skip ahead just a little bit in terms of Susan Markvey's diagnosis and you know, what doctors were saying about her condition, her glioblastoma, during the course and after this diagnosis. The record, the briefs certainly describe this, and I think the medical records do as well, as incurable. It's an incurable form of brain cancer, and as we know, tragically, it was fatal in Susan Markey's case. Was there or is there evidence, medical evidence, that suggests that at some point doctors were more optimistic about her chances of recovering, or was it the case that sadly this was something that people understood would ultimately be fatal? Could you help me understand the state of where things are at? I realize it's a summary judgment. I don't want to get into disputed facts, but is there something that I can rely upon in the record for that information?
I know of no medical record that would indicate that her condition was going to get to ever back to a state where she would be deemed not being affected by the brain cancer.
Was there something that suggested she might get better?
No, nothing that I'm aware of. And so, along those lines, what's
The reason I ask is that the party seemed to think that agree, and maybe they're right, that the standard for determining capacity is our capacity to contract rule from 2011A1. We also have cases, as you may know, that suggest that in instances where someone disposes of property and they're contemplating death, even though it's not a will, we have some cases where we have applied a testamentary capacity test, which, I mean, we could talk about whether that's different or how that's different, but in any event, it's got a different name anyway, and maybe it has some differences. So I'm trying to figure out what test we would use to determine at least perhaps the quick claim deed, and we'll leave the power of attorney off to the side for a minute.
I believe that the test for determining the competency of somebody entering into a contract is more stricter, is tougher than the testamentary capacity of a person who is signing a will. The contract for deed, or excuse me, the quick claim deed and the power of attorney that was signed by Susan Markey on the 25th of March 2014 were signed with the assistance of somebody putting an X next to the signature line, obviously to help her understand where she was supposed to sign. The question is whether or not she understood what she was signing. And we believe that there is sufficient evidence brought forth to the trial court for the trial court to put that in question. In fact, I think there are a number of instances in the trial court's opinion where the trial court raised the question of the validity of the appointment of the power of attorney. And in doing so, but yet not resolving that in the trial court's opinion, there's the error.
Did the trial court address capacity separately, or was it sort of seemed like it might have been an adjunct to undue influence?
I believe the trial, I'm sorry.
Did the circuit court judge address capacity as a separate issue, or was it just sort of part of the analysis of undue influence?
As a separate issue, I believe the trial court relied on the opinion or the observations of Brian Haig as being the evidence, quote, that strongly supported, which indicates or refers that there was a weighing of evidence, strongly supported that Susan Markey had the competency or mental capacity to enter into those two documents on the 25th of March. The observations of a compensated attorney were outweighed, did outweigh the other evidence that was presented by the appellant at the trial level. That other evidence included two affidavits, Susan's sister, Susan's brother, which again indicated a number of instances where she was exhibiting unusual behavior, medical records, in the affidavit of Dr. Manlove. There was no mentioning in the trial court's opinion about Manlove's affidavit, that Manlove had serious believed that a person who was suffering from an incurable type of cancer that she was suffering from, that Susan Markey was suffering from, could understand what was being transferred or whether she was transferring any property or any rights when she signed the power of attorney and the quitclaim deed, which those two documents ended up being the first nominal in the line of dominoes that brings us here. There are six causes of action that are all affected by whether or not there was a proper appointment for the power of attorney. And the trial court had no analysis, provided nothing in its opinion as to whether or not the moving party had met its burden of proof. When we have a situation where somebody has a confidential relationship with it, somebody who is not a testator but is in a compromised situation, and then that person is there during the preparation and execution of important documents, those documents ended up being to that person's benefit. The trial court just relied upon, again, the observations of Brian Haig. When those observations were made is uncertain, and the non-moving party here did not get the chance to depose Brian Haig or the defendant. That's the third reason why we're asking that this court reverse the trial court. It's because, again, discovery hadn't been completed. And important questions were ruled upon by the trial court at a motions hearing where a motion to compel was brought forth for the defendant to answer 16 interrogatories. And a number of these interrogatories pertain to what was the relationship between Brian Haig and the decedent and the defendant. I'll try. approximately hour-long hearing on the motion to compel where there were a number of interrogatories that were being questioned. And
maybe, I'm sorry, I read the hearing transcript, but my question goes more toward what was presented to the court after the hearing.
Okay. There were emails between opposing counsel and the court for the timing of the order. And the language of the order to compel. During those discussions or emails, there was no reference to whether or not discovery would be required or expected by the trial court before the rendering of the summary judgment opinion. I think a reasonable person who goes through a hearing such as that in where material issues are resolved to the non-moving party's benefit for purposes of discovery, it's hard to understand why a trial court who believes that that information is necessary would still nonetheless rule on summary judgment.
But was that all the trial court's doing? Because at the end of the transcript, I read that I believe that you had suggested you could have a supplemental brief in to the court as early as a week, and I think you originally, or then you got 2 weeks. But I thought you were also in charge of drafting the order on the motion to compel, which set a couple of deadlines out, one for the protective order, but for the ones dealing with Mr. Haig, that was 30 days after the order. So did you ever go back to the trial court judge and say, hey, Judge, we might not get Rule 56F relief, but can I at least have enough time to get the responses that you've ordered produced until I have to submit my motion, or excuse me, my supplemental brief? Did you ever go back and say, hey, there's a disconnect here?
I did not, okay. Justice Alter. And
am I right? I mean, there is a disconnect. I mean, the deadline that was set by the order, and am I right in thinking that, I mean, you drafted the order, perhaps, you know, with, you know, the concurrence of counsel, but that became problematic, it seems like, in the sequence of events.
It did. We're asking here for this court to nonetheless still reverse the trial court, even if there was an error on the part of counsel for the appellant, and not pursuing that clarification and getting an understanding as to when discovery would be produced. Nonetheless, we believe that there was still other errors. We believe that there was sufficient evidence for the trial court to have denied the motion for summary judgment, that there were numerous questions of fact.
Mr. Nelson, your time's over. Thank you.
Thank you.
Slammers, Bogart, you have 15 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel, and law clerks, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. First, I want to start by saying that the issues that Mr. Nelson recited to you as those being on appeal today are not what were contained in his notice of appeal. There were various other issues in the notice of appeal pertaining more to whether there was a question of fact on the various claims, the multiple claims that Gus Johnson brought against my client, Ken Markvie. So I want to reverse a little and go back to what the trial court took into account. It was extensive. We had three hearings, whether it be between a motion for summary judgment hearing, motion to compel, or status hearing, all addressing these same issues. There were, I counted, 12 substantive filings. Again, whether that be through motion for summary judgment and responses, Rule 56F affidavits, and opposition to those, motion to compel, opposition, and as Justice Salter mentioned, the supplemental briefs at the very end. And in addition to all of this information that the trial court had to review, the trial court issued an extensive opinion. Not a one-page opinion, multiple pages analyzing every issue at length. And counsel for Mr. Johnson cannot show that the trial court in any way, even though it's a review, I admit, de novo, as this court has said, the court will affirm the circuit court's ruling granting a motion for summary judgment if any basis exists to support the ruling. And that's from the Eagle Ridge Estates Homeowners Association case.
Counsel, can you speak to the conversion claim with reference to Nina Braun's opinion that there was some $415,000 that was not accounted for the care and expense of Susan Martin's $50,000 transfer? Are these questions of fact?
Your Honor, that also addresses Mr. Nelson's claim that the trial court was weighing evidence. The trial court was not weighing any evidence. It's the duty of the trial court to determine what facts are material. And, of course, determined that there were no material facts in dispute here in Gus Johnson's favor. As to Nina Braun's report, the trial court did address that report and indicated there isn't a dispute. Nina Braun said there were 80-some thousand dollars in cash taken out of the account. Yes, that's exactly what my client's spreadsheet set forth. And it also set forth that he expended that amount to care for his wife by way of home caretakers and other matters. And, of course, he expended thousands of dollars when she was in the hospital, subsequently moved to Crawford, Nebraska, to a nursing home, and then to a place called Ministry of Health, also in Crawford, all very expensive. There was no reference to the amount that I think Nina Braun indicated should have gone to the estate. I believe it was $50-some thousand, because it was a joint account, and I gather this is why Mr. Nelson also didn't address it in the brief, because it was a joint account, so surely that money would have gone back to the joint account and not to the estate. So Mr. Markvie had what was left in that account. But the evidence also shows that he spent some of that money buying shares for her retirement income also. And I think the reference to Mr. Markvie having spent 200 some thousand over what a reasonable person would spend to care for his wife, I think there's a reason that's not argued by Mr. Nelson either, because he spent what he thought he should spend for her. And I don't doubt that in Hot Springs, South Dakota, finding home caregivers is expensive. And she was quite ill for years, 2 years before she passed away. But I do want to make sure to point out that everything that Mr. Markvie did was consistent with the prenuptial agreement. Gus Johnson agrees that the prenup was valid. There's never been a dispute of that. But I think what's getting lost is that in that prenup, it specifically provides that the two could, at a later point, purchase property together, or that he or she could transfer to each other real property or personal property. That's exactly what happened here with the quitclaim deed. Of course, transferring to both of them, and she had purchased it when Mr. Markvie was in Alaska where he had some property, and so it was more of logistics. They had previously entered into a purchase agreement for different property that then they backed out on. But that's consistent with both of them wanting to purchase the property together. And what I also think it's lost in this case is that it makes sense. They're a married couple living together. Surely she wants her husband to maintain this home after she passes. Well, but
can we be sure of that? I mean, the many of the cases that you cite and that the parties cite, and I'm just trying to recall the one that is in my mind right now, deal with Perry was one, Schmidt perhaps another. These are Smith with an SMID, and then Perry, the one from Parker. These are cases that involved jury trials, or excuse me, court trials, but in any event, fact finding. And so as we get into what may be expected or what people may perceive as being normal, or the court working hard on the summary judgment issues, doesn't it seem like the questions that we're talking about are ill-suited for summary judgment? Because that's where we are, and many of the cases that are cited in the briefs are not summary judgment cases. Those are review after fact-finding with deference to whatever the fact-finder determined.
The difference here, Your Honor, is there is not one shred of evidence that Susan did not want Ken Markvie to have their marital home and live in it after she passed. Not one. And while counsel...
Is that a different question than she wanted? She may well have wanted that, but isn't there an additional question about whether she wanted him or whether there was an expectation that he would participate in some way in its acquisition? She may well have wanted that. The question is, did she want to give him that? And as it relates to that, maybe. You don't have to agree with that, but I'm going to roll into another question. That circles me back to capacity, which I didn't see as being broken out into a discrete topic in the circuit court's opinion. Should it have been, or should it not have been, or that's question one. Question two, I'm really curious about what rules we apply for capacity. How do we determine that?
The trial court did, in fact, address Susan's capacity, and there's no dispute to any of these facts that the court referenced that Susan met with Brian Haig 2 times before she signed the quitclaim deed and the POA. The court had affidavits in front of them from caregivers and friends stating that she knew what was going on. still playing complex bridge, in fact, tournaments, after her diagnosis and while she was living at home under the caregiver's care.
But if you construe those, if you say that really points to capacity, is that the right standard under Rule 56? Because don't we have to look at all the evidence, which would include the medical records, which, do you acknowledge, contain some references at a minimum to cognitive difficulties that Susan Markby is experiencing in and around that time period in 2014 when she executes the quitclaim deed and the POA? I mean, that's there. I mean, it says what it says. Would you
yes,
agree with me?
But the trial court found, and I of course agree, that that's not material. How she may have references in the records, medical records, while she was in the hospital to having periods of difficulty with her mental capacity.
Why wouldn't it be material?
Because she understood the documents. The standard
and we know,
is...
And we know this because there are two lines in an affidavit from a lawyer that tell us that.
Not just that, Your Honor. In addition to the lawyer, we have the affidavits from caregivers and friends saying that she knew what was going on. She wanted Ken to live in that house.
The friends, by the way, I wasn't clear when I read those affidavits if that related to a period of time after the March time period in 2014 or when that was exactly. The medical records, of course, are very clear. They're in and around that period of time. So we can tell with some certainty how things are going, up days, down days. Not certainly it's somewhat mixed, but
even her
part of the case.
Even her medical providers testified in their deposition that she may have had periods of incapacity, but ultimately knew what was going on. And certainly 2 years passed after she signed those documents. There's not one shred of evidence, again, to suggest that she regretted it, wanted to change anything about it. She didn't change any of her estate planning. Gus Johnson still got the remainder of the estate.
Wouldn't we have to weigh the evidence to see how good that evidence was initially, and then as it played out, that sort of confirms the factual determination. But before I get to that, I want to let you respond to that, but I really want to know about what you think about the rules that we use to determine capacity. Because it seems like there might be two rules that are implicated here. There's the contract capacity, and then there's the testamentary capacity. And I know that you both agreed that it seems as though the contract capacity standard is what you think is implicated here. But I'm trying to figure out if in March of 2014 there's evidence that, you know, the quitclaim deed anyway was done in contemplation of Susan passing, or do we know that, or is there disputed issues on that, or would that be judged by a testamentary capacity standard in any event or not? I know I'm catching you cold on that.
No, that's fine.
I appreciate whatever thoughts you have.
I would agree with the trial court with the interpretation of contract law that she certainly was capable of understanding the transactions or the documents, but it leads also into the undue influence, whether you consider it.
Was there some factual evidence that indicated that she might get better, this was going to be fatal or terminal? Do we know that? And was this, what do we know about whether this was done in contemplation of her passing away, if anything?
It is my understanding it was always considered terminal. However, her mental abilities improved through time, which is shown by the evidence. And one of her friends was saying her physical abilities were deteriorating, but mentally she was still there and doing well. So there's no evidence to support at all that she did not understand the documents or that she was somehow, you know, persuaded by Mr. Markvy. And before my time is up, I want to make sure to point out that the prenuptial agreement also was very clear in giving, in this situation, Ken 100% ability to spend what he needed to care for her. And in fact, the prenup says that when one's disabled, not only is the other in charge of spending the money, but is supposed to use the disabled's money entirely. And Ken went beyond that. He didn't just use her money. He used the joint account. to pay for the various things that he did that, of course, got expensive. Important to note that this isn't a situation with a third party, a caregiver, or even a distant relative. This is her husband, who's spending money to care for her, and who ends up with the home that the prenup allows them to purchase together. So she clearly had anticipated it then. That was long before she had been diagnosed with any kind of cancer. And as it relates to the deed and the power of attorney, it's only that at issue here. The remainder of her estate never changed. In fact, after she married Mr. Mark V, she made a change to her trust only to change her last name. Clearly, she knew what she was doing.
We don't have the trust document in the record, or do we? I didn't see it. You may not know. If you don't know, that's just fine. Don't take your time.
I thought we did, Your Honor, as an attachment to an affidavit, but it could be wrong. And again, everything that Mr. Mark V did by way of power of attorney or the contract for deed was consistent with the prenup, and we ask that the court affirm the trial court's well-analyzed opinion. Thank you.
Mr. Nelson, you have 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you. In response to the moving party, the appellee's arguments here on a couple of issues, Justice Kern had inquired about the conversion, the allegations of conversion brought by my client. What the trial court failed to consider, along with the transfers of money within the bank accounts, was there's also furniture. In the prenuptial agreement, it was specified that there's furniture that was going to be retained by the estate or by her trust. Mr. Markey kept that furniture, was never ever transferred back into the estate, along with there was about $50,000 in the joint account that was never accounted for. We submit that Mr. Markey should have had been held as a fiduciary to Susan V. Markey, should have been held to doing an accounting of all those monies that were commingled and supposedly used for Susan's benefit during her disability, her being affected by the brain cancer. Secondly, I'd like to counter what was said by opposing counsel in regards to whether there was any shred of evidence that there was an intent by Susan Markey to transfer the house to Kenneth Markey. The facts preceding the illness, the affliction from cancer, all are consistent with Susan's intent not to allow Mr. Markey to own the home. Again, in August of 2013, she purchased the home with her own monies, her own property, and she deeded it into the trust. If her intent, just a few months prior to signing the deed, and the quitclaim deed and the power of attorney, was to allow her husband to be a successor to that property, that would have been the opportune time for her to do so. It was just the opposite. The prenuptial agreement, its purpose was, again, to keep the properties separate. It contemplated incapacity, illnesses, and so forth. But still, the purpose was to keep properties separate. Mr. Markey's got over, according to the prenuptial agreement, had over $2 million in assets. Susan Markey had $1 million. They both were financially set in their positions in life, and they wanted to protect those positions. And it was clear, there's also evidence that prior their prior engagement, the reason why the wedding was canceled was because Mr. Markey was upset with Susan not agreeing to put this. There was another house in Hot Springs that they were looking at to purchase, the Flock, called the Flock House. Susan Markey specifically refused to allow that to go forward because Mr. Markey was not contributing towards that purchase, and that caused a disengagement.
Is that on the record?
Oh, go ahead, please.
Did you ever receive the answers to the interrogatories after the motion to compel or the order to compel was entered, or does the record reflect that?
No, Justice Devaney. They were due 3 days after the order for summary judgment was entered, and they were never produced. And a number of those interrogatories pertain to, again, the relationship between Susan Markvie and Kenneth Markvie and Brian Haig. Susan Markvie had another attorney, Mark Walters, who had done all of her trust work. The question is, why would she go when she's suffering from an incurable cancer, change attorneys midstream during her affliction, and go to an attorney that apparently was there was a pre-existing relationship between Mr. Markvie and Brian Haig. And so those interrogatories pertain to trying to understand that relationship, what was occurring, why was it that after leaving the hospital, literally leaving the hospital, they went to Brian Haig's office for the purpose of drafting these two documents. Excuse me. The reference by opposing counsel about the caretakers, we don't know when they made those observations, how pertinent they're not. I don't think they're skilled in making any determination about some. Thank you. Appreciate it.
That will conclude the argument. The case is now submitted. Thank you, counsel.